We're here to speak with you about your experiences in World War II for the Homefront series that we're putting together. And if you could start out by telling me your name, your age, and your hometown, sir.
All right. My name is Edward L. Vasek, and I was born and raised on a farm north of Avon. And my birthday is the 29th of March. I was born in 1924 at Scotland, South Dakota. And when the war started, I graduated from Avon High School in the spring of 1941. And at that time, the war was getting started, and I thought I should get into defense. Well, I was too young, so I went to what they called the Morton Aircraft School in Omaha. And I graduated from that, and I was still too young, so I worked in the Castle Hotel as a busboy in Omaha. And then in February of 1942, I hitchhiked back home to South Dakota. And then in April, I got a phone call from the Curtis Wright Division in Buffalo, New York, to come to work. So I worked in Buffalo, New York, making parts for the P-40 fighter planes and the C-46 planes. And I worked there till my draft number came up, and I asked the draft board in Buffalo, New York, if I could transfer back to South Dakota, which I did. And so then I left for the service in April of 1943 from Tyndall, South Dakota, went to Fort Crook, Nebraska, where I was inducted. Then I had 7 days off, came back home. And then after that, I went down to Fort Leavenworth, Kansas, where I went through a lot of paperwork and investigating. And from Fort Leavenworth, Kansas, I then preferred that I would like to get into the Air Force. So I was shipped off to Kearns Field, Utah, which is southwest of Salt Lake City. And that's where I got my basic training. And after I got through with basic training, I then was assigned to the Lowry Field in Denver, Colorado, where I learned to operate the machine gun and different turrets. And after graduating there, I was then sent to the gunnery school at Nellis Field in Las Vegas, Nevada. And I went through gunnery school at Las Vegas. And then after that, I had about 7 days at home. And then after that, I was assigned to Salt Lake City Air Base, where they formed crews. And that's when I was formed on a crew. We left Salt Lake City on December 31st, 1943, and I wound up at Rapid City, South Dakota, at the Rapid City Air Base. And that's where our crew took our training. At that time, it was a 398 bomb group. And the 398 bomb group, of course, I never knew this at the time, but the 398 bomb group was the last complete bomb group to go overseas as a group. And when we finished training, unbeknown to us, we were considered an extra crew, so we didn't get one of the brand new B-17s, which the 398 got at that time. So we went by train to Grand Island, Nebraska, and that's where we got our plane with all the equipment. And after leaving one day, we got over Des Moines, and the radio operator had a problem with his ears, so we had to return to Grand Island. And at that time, they were getting ready to close the Grand Island Air Base to make it ready for the Black Widow fighter plane. So from Grand Island, we flew to Kearney, Nebraska. And we were there a couple days. And then after that, we flew from Kearney, Nebraska, across country to Bangor, Maine, which was a long ways. And that was the first time I got to eat lobster. And I love lobster to this day.
Oh, good for you. Good for you.
And then from Bangor, Maine, we flew then to Goose Bay, Labrador. And we stayed there overnight. It was cold. And from Goose Bay, we went and landed at Iceland, which was the daytime and nighttime was all the same. But we landed at Iceland. And from Iceland, we flew then to Glasgow, Scotland. And the enlisted men went to a ground gunnery training school there for, I don't know, a number of days. And the officers went to another place. And unbeknown to us, After that, we got together, and our crew was assigned to the 398 through the 381st Bomb Group at a place in England, about 50 miles northeast of London. And I forget the name of the little town. I got it in there, but I can't think of it right now. But anyway, we flew our first mission on the pilot flew his first mission on the 7th of June, which was D-Day. And then after that, we flew as a crew on different missions. And after we had three missions, I think it was three or four missions, we flew for 7 days straight. And of those 7 days, it was twice to Hamburg, twice to Bordeaux, France, to Berlin. And I'll tell you, after 7 days of being on oxygen and getting up in the wee hours of the morning and then coming back, we were all pretty well bushed. But after that, we continued to fly, and God was with us all the way. And then on the 22nd of September of 1944, my pilot and I finished our 34th mission with the 381st Bomb Group. And we were so thankful. We returned back to a place in Scotland where we were assigned for a few days. And then we returned to the United States on the Dutch ship, the Normandy. And we landed in Boston Harbor. And on the way, I was sick at times, but not that sick. But then they brought some Canadian sailors down into our bunk area. And they were so sick, that just made me sick. And didn't eat hardly at all because of all their problems. But anyway, we were thankful that we were back in the United States, landing at Boston. And from Boston, I went to Camp Miles Standish, which was just not too far from the Boston Harbor there. And from there, I made a phone call to our Catholic chaplain that was on the base, Father O'Connor. I called his mother to tell her where I was from and that I was in the care of God, and with her son being a priest at 381st Bomb Group. And from there, went by train through New York and Pittsburgh and so forth and so on, and came back to Minneapolis, and then for 30 days at home in good old South Dakota, back on the farm. And after my 30 days, I then was assigned to Miami Beach, Florida, which was a great thing. We had a nice hotel. And now at Miami Beach, went through different seminars, questioning. And I was questioned if I'd like to get on the B-29s. And I said, thank you, I've had enough. So after that, I was assigned to a gunnery school, a B-24 place at, I forget the name of, I can't think of it, or the name of the place right now. But anyway, I was there training gunners on the B-24s, and I was having a few problems. And then I was assigned to Yuma, Arizona. And from Yuma, Arizona, I finally got the medics to admit me to the Army Air Force Hospital at Santa Ana, California. And I was at Santa Ana from, I think it was about April of 1945. And we would hitchhike from Santa Ana to Los Angeles to Hollywood, the Hollywood Canteen, and all over. And one day, hitchhiking back from Los Angeles to Santa Ana, the wife of a fighter pilot called Gentle Annie picked me up. That was unknown to me, and I was such... so happy because her husband escorted us across the North Sea after we had two engines shot out and we needed a private escort across the North Sea. So after that, of course, came the Jap. My brother, of course, was in the Navy attached to the Marines, and he made the invasion of Saipan and Iwo Jima, which were terrible places. But anyway, then in the September 4th, I think it was 4th, Japanese surrendered And I got on a train and I went back to Fort Leavenworth, Kansas, where I was discharged. And amen, that was the end of my military life with the United States Army Air Force.
So you didn't want to hang around.
I didn't want to hang around any longer.
Okay, let's back up just a little bit, please, here. Ed, how old were you when you were drafted?
I was 18 years old.
Because you said you wanted to get in sooner and they wouldn't let you.
That wouldn't let me go. Okay. That's right.
And what was the appeal of the Air Force? Was it all the time you'd spent around aircraft? Was that something you'd always been interested in?
Yes, I was interested. Matter of fact, when I was in Buffalo, New York, I applied to get into, I wanted to be a fighter pilot. And of course I didn't have enough smarts, I mean, mathematic wise. And so I never made the grade. But so then I was drafted, of course. Like I said, the draft board in Buffalo, New York called me up and I asked for a transfer back to my draft board at Tyndall, South Dakota. And that's where I returned back and then went from Tyndall with the group to Fort Crook.
Yeah.
And then I had 7 days off from that, and then from Fort Crook went to Fort Leavenworth, Kansas, where I went, proceeded on.
Okay. And you said you were trained as a gunner.
Yes.
So you...
I was a ball turret gunner on a B-17.
Oh, boy. didn't ball turret gunners have notoriously short lifespans?
Well, yes, they did. And I have to tell you, one of our missions, which was about the 22nd mission, coming back from a mission in Germany, we were going across the Zuider Zee in Holland, and I and the ball turret, I looked all around, there was no fighter action, no flak, and all of a sudden there was a big crash, and I still didn't see no fighters, no flak. And then the waist gunner come on the intercom, he says, yeah, I see you up here. So I rode down my turret, opened the hatch, and looked, and in the middle of the B-17, there was this plywood catwalk, and he looked like a porcupine because he was full of slivers from this catwalk. And whatever it was, missed my turret by about 2 inches and went out and took out the right waist window. So I'm going to call my pilot tomorrow because I do that every year and he calls me many times too, to reminisce how we were spared. If it was, it had to be a shell of some kind to go up like that, go up from the bottom of the B-17 and take the right waist window out. And if it would have went just 2 inches, it would have got my ball turret. So that's the way it was. And speaking of the ball turret, at first, about the first 19 missions, I would have my parachute harness outside of the turret. I had my harness on, but the chute was outside. And I thought, well, I seen planes go down. And I thought, well, why don't I see if I can get a back type chute? Because if we get hit, maybe I can just roll the turret down and go out. Well, the good Lord was with us, and I had the back type chute, but never had to use a chute at all.
Okay.
And of course, one time, maybe it was at that same time when that missile went up, it took the right window out, right waist window. I get my, there was a parachute outside there. So I got that parachute and I brought it home, and my wife's mother made her wedding dress out of that parachute.
Is that right? Oh my gosh. So did you leave a sweetheart behind?
No.
No.
I had a good relationship with the English people. I went to rest home for 7 days at Southampton, I think it is called. But had a good rest home there and played golf, went to dances. But matter of fact, there was a English girl there, she would have liked to get married. And I figured, well, yeah, get married and come to the United States. But I was in no hurry or no mood to get married. And so I just went back from the rest camp. We went back to camp and then we finished up our tour of missions there. And that was the end of it.
So you met your wife after you got home?
After I got home, I met my wife at a dance at Tyndall and got married. And just this last June, we celebrated our 60th wedding anniversary. And our kids, we have 4 girls and 2 sons, and they had all concocted to take us down to Omaha, Nebraska, where we were put up in a big hotel there. And all the all the kids and all the relatives and even our granddaughter, who is an attorney now, and she's been in China for 3 years, she even came. And I have a daughter that's a warrant officer 3 in the Washington National Guard in Spanaway, Washington. So we had a great turnout as far as the 60th anniversary.
It sounds like it. So what was your rank then when you were in the military?
I was a staff sergeant in the military.
Now, you entered the war after, well, what, sorry, let me get my thoughts sure. gathered here. Where were you and what were you doing when D-Day, when Pearl Harbor was attacked?
When Pearl Harbor was attacked, I was a busboy in the Castle Hotel in Omaha, and it came across the news there, and there was a military people from Omaha Corps of Engineers eating there. Pearl Harbor was bombed. Well, where's Pearl Harbor? What's Pearl Harbor? Nobody knew what Pearl Harbor was, but that was the first inkling that we had of that war was declared. And the next day, of course, President Roosevelt made a speech there, and we were in war with Japan, and of course after that it was Germany, and from there on it was the war.
Mm-hmm. Now you got out, or you didn't have any interest in staying in once you were out. So how did you feel about the United States being involved in the war to begin with?
In the World War II?
Yes.
Well, I knew it was something that was provoked on us. We didn't start it, and I deeply feel sorry for all the people that lost their lives at Pearl Harbor and throughout the war as far as that goes. And a number of years ago, our daughter, that's the warrant officer, she had arranged for us to go to Hawaii, and we were with her, and we made the trip to where the Arizona is sunk. And it breaks my heart to think of all the poor people, poor fellas, men and women, that were crucified throughout the wars. And to my way of thinking, why are people still fighting? Why are they fighting? We're fighting now in Iraq, in all over, well, wherever. And it just doesn't make any sense to me. And I guess wars will go on forever and ever, apparently. Nobody seems to care about living.
What are the things about your memories of the war that are that stand out? You know, the smells of the place, you know, to be in Europe. I mean, are there specific things that you think about when you think about the war that go beyond sitting in that ball turret, or things about being in that ball turret?
Well, being with the 381st Bomb Group, there were 4 enlisted men crews in a barracks. The officers were separate from us. And of those 4 crews, we were the only crew that ever finished. There were 3 crews that never made it back. One of the crews, I recall, they landed in Denmark or Sweden after they couldn't make it back. But fortunately, I must say that we were one of the 4 crews, we were one of the only crew during my time that finished up the whole tour out of that barracks. And later part of September there, one night we were playing cards and we heard this German buzz bomb, which went past our place about 250 yards away. And I've got pieces of shrapnel of that as it landed beyond our complex there. That was one of the highlights for me, because I've got pieces of that someplace at home.
What about food and other elements of life in the military?
Well, as far as food was concerned, we always, to my way of thinking, had good food, but we enlisted fellas, somebody would get some bread, somebody would get some butter, bring it back to the barracks, and then we'd go over to the English neighborhood there and buy some tomatoes, and we'd make cheese. I mean, not cheese, but
toasted tomato sandwiches?
Toasted tomato sandwiches.
That actually sounds kind of good.
And then, of course, there was a few times where we had chocolate ice cream, which was a great treat for us. Man, that was a great treat.
So you were stationed mostly in England.
Yes.
And what was it like? Did you have the opportunity to interact with the British who lived in that same area, or was it mostly military?
Well, we did with this English couple that farmed right next to the base, and like I say, where we got those tomatoes there. And matter of fact, my pilot has been over there, and those people have indicated they would sure like to have me come back and visit them, but I'll be 84 in March, and it's just beyond me. I would have liked to go on over there and see him again. And like I say, we were like, Ridgewell was a little town that the base was close to. And when we'd go on pass, there would be three of us enlisted men and our pilot. We'd go on pass to London, and we'd stay in a hotel there, and we had a great time on pass. We'd ride the train to London and back to Colchester and then to Ridgewell. But all in all, and the pilot, his folks, I think, originally had some connection with English people. But anyway, he has written a couple of books now, and I keep a close correspondence with my pilot, because I call him maybe once or twice a year, and Christmas cards, and he likewise calls me. Matter of fact, tomorrow I'll be calling him. It'll be the anniversary of our 34th mission in 1944.
Wow. So you got out of the military, the Army, you came home, you got married, and what did you do with the rest of your life then?
Well, after I got married, I was working in Tyndall, and then there was a farmer friend from north of our farm, Bob Merrick by name. He was a personnel officer for the Corps of Engineers at Pittstown, which was starting up, and he wanted me to come out and work. And I had, in the summer of 47, I had gone to what was called the Coyne Electrical School in Chicago. And I got through that, and I didn't think I had enough smarts to come to Pittstown to start a generator plant. But then about a week later, he called me again. He says, come on down and work. So I came to Pittstown to work on September 8th, 1947. I was assigned to survey crew. And we surveyed, imagine the 8-lane bowling alley, the hospital, and different buildings. And then on Veterans Day of 47, our survey crew was sent to Chamberlain, South Dakota, to do x-ray of the relocation of the railroad in that area. So that was supposed to be for 30 days, but those 30 days wound up being the 16th of May of 1948.
A little more than 30 days.
And it was a very hard winter, because the next day after Veterans Day, we got up, we were in this motel, we got up, and there was a blizzard on. You couldn't see your hand in front of your face. But we had a party chief from Nebraska that believed in giving the government a day's work for a dollar's pay, and we were out looking for benchmarkers
in the
blizzard. And so from there on, of course, we surveyed, like I say, till the 16th of May of 1948. Then we came back to Pittstown, and we did some more surveying. And at that time, going through medical process, VA, I was told I should get off of a survey. Matter of fact, I wound up in the vet's hospital in Lincoln, Nebraska, and they said I should get off a survey. So I was assigned to, there's a big warehouse down there. I was assigned as a property and supply clerk. And I worked there for a couple of years, and then I was assigned to another place called the Outlet Works section, where I had 45 inspectors and engineers, kept their payroll, and I was had to take and inspect government furnished materials that were coming into Pickstown on the railroad. And we had as many as a maximum was 102 freight cars in one day of parts for the generators in the powerhouse. And after that, I had taken a government exam for a powerhouse operator. So then in February of 1952, the wife and I and two of our little children, we were off for Fort Peck, Montana, to go to this operator school. And there were, I think, either 13 or 14 of us there in the operator school. And we finished that up in July of 1953, at which time we came back to Pickstown. And of course, the powerhouse was nowhere near being ready to be run, so we were all assigned to different jobs. And I, for instance, was assigned to X-ray inspection. All the welding on the surge tanks, of which there are eight, and all the penstocks were welded, and that had to be all X-rayed. And so I was in charge of that, looking over the X-rays. And then one Saturday night, I was looking at some X-rays and what the contractor had done on the surge tank number three. Instead of having a complete section, he welded on about a 18-piece section to this one section, and there were about three links above that. And of course, after that, my name was mud because the contractor had to remove that whole section of the surge tank. Mm-hmm. But anyway, after that, in December of 53, then, all of us operators got together in the powerhouse, started reading our blueprints and finding our way around the powerhouse. And from there on, the powerhouse was built, and the first unit went on the line in February of 54. And after that, it just progressed until the last unit, number eight unit generator, went on the line. And I had a good close association with all the fellows that were operators and maintenance people and all the workers. And I got to see the place from roots up.
Start to finish.
From start to finish is right. And after that, of course, then in 1985, I was riding this small motorcycle to work, and I was got off of work at 8 o'clock in the morning, and I remember going about 100 yards, and then an operator that had been on shift with me the week prior to that had a new pickup, and according to the report, he made this illegal left turn in front of me, and I laid out there sprawled on the road. And it was fortunate there was a fellow out in the switch yard that saw it. Well, anyway, the end result was I was flown to Omaha with a broken leg and concussion of 22 days. And after that, they did a terrific job on getting my leg fixed in Omaha. And then I came back afterwards when I got recuperated. And in the spring of 85, I got back on shift, and I worked that summer. And there was a young fellow that just finished his training, and they wanted to, Corps of Engineers wanted to send him to Riverdale, North Dakota, to the power plant up there. And he didn't like that very well. And I kind of liked the guy, so I said, just hang tight, and I'll retire. So I retired on September 8th, 1945, from the Corps of Engineers powerhouse.
Okay, now you got run over by a coworker.
Yes.
And hurt, but it doesn't sound like you were ever injured during the war.
No, I was not.
You made it through the war unscathed, so that you could come home and somebody could break your leg with a truck.
That's right. Okay. That's right. That's
now,
right.
Now, we only have a couple more minutes left because I know they've got some other folks out there, but did you have brothers and sisters, family back home here? Did you have any Was anyone else in your family in the service at the same time you were?
Yes. My brother joined the Navy in 1942, I think. And in the Navy, he was a corpsman, and he was assigned to the Marines. So he made the invasion of Saipan and Iwo Jima, which were, as you know, very, very costly and deadly places. And of course, my brother passed away a year ago now.
But he
did make it home.
Okay.
And then I had two sisters, and they're both gone. And my brother passed away a year ago, so I'm the only survivor of the family.
Were you able to communicate with your family while you were overseas at all?
Oh, yes. Of course, our letters were censored, but there was a writing in the Reader's Digest, and I have it, about our being over there. So I wrote to folks, and I says, get this particular Reader's Digest and read it, because it gave all the information about us in there. But as far as writing what we were doing or where we were at, we couldn't mention that in our letters.